Okay, so who are you and why are you here?
My name is Jared Nelson. I'm here because I'm working with Carl Strong and Bill Cochran on a new project called Pursuit Cycles.
Okay, so you're a three-man team. I talked to Carl yesterday. That was really nice. I have a lot of respect for Carl. He's one of the best guys in the industry in terms of builders.
Phenomenal welder, too.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like I said to him yesterday, he works with every material.
He does.
There's very few builders that do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a three-man squad for this new venture. He's obviously still doing Strong, but now you're going to do Pursuit. What's your role there?
So Carl and Bill are kind of the big guns behind it, and I'm supporting with some engineering work. I have a background in composite materials and have been in and around the composites industry and the bike industry for quite a while. Try to keep a low profile, but they're trying to change that, unfortunately.
Well, it's tough. You got to sell. We met last night at the bar, and you were talking about some of your past. Why don't you sort of review, like, sort of, you know, you're maybe a Grom, you maybe worked in a shop, but then you went to school, you did some fancy stuff. Let's talk about that.
Actually, I'm going to go backwards if you don't mind.
Sure.
Right now my day job is I work as an academic. I'm a faculty member at a small university in the Hudson Valley in New York called SUNY New Paltz. I teach mechanical engineering there, and I specialize in composite materials and solid mechanics. And I do composites related and 3D printed research to support that. So
your theoretical stuff or application?
Highly applicable. I'm not smart enough to be a theoretical guy.
I work with physics and astronomy people, and we have our practical experimentalists and we have our theoreticians, and it's very difficult to find a joint between the two.
Yeah, I am an experimentalist. I got my start in industry. Before I went back to school, I was actually here in Salt Lake, and I worked for the company that at the time bought Reynolds and Lou and started making wheels here in the Salt Lake Valley. And so I worked with them on other projects. I wasn't part of the Reynolds team, but I worked on automotive projects. We developed a hood for Corvette and so forth. And then kind of on the in-between, my master's research and my PhD research were both related to composite materials for industry. So I've really tried to keep that industry focus as the common thread through my entire career.
That's really nice. As we both know, being in an academic environment, sometimes there's very little connect to what actually happens and very little understanding of what actually happens. And there's a lot of legend and lore that isn't even real.
Yeah, I agree. My big goal. So I am my life's work. So when I look back on my life, my research life, I should say, and leave the other stuff out for now, I want to be able to say I had some small impact on developing an understanding of how composite materials fail. I think that, you know, we have a good fundamental understanding, and there are some really good assumptions that have been made, some of them decades ago. But I think we're ready and we have new technologies available to us that can help us develop a better understanding.
What are the specific things you're looking for? You're looking, obviously, on a microscopic level, but you're probably fatiguing and straining things. Like, what kind of failures are you talking about? And I'm sure you're talking about failures that start 5 years before the actual catastrophe.
In some cases, yeah. So I did I've done a lot of work with trying to understand the effects of manufacturing defects. So one of the big issues.
That's nice because it rhymes.
It does. It does. It sounds really good. I wish I could say that I came up with that, but I didn't. So it's developing an understanding of what happens to these materials when, for example, you have an air pocket, voids, fiber waviness. So all of these things contribute to a degradation that results in a lower performance value. So you're going to see a lower strength. You're going to see a reduction in stiffness. And so trying to quantify and understand those things, I think will help us develop this global understanding of how composites fail. And I think it is. You mentioned the micro versus the macro scale. I think we really need to develop an understanding across all scales. You know, I think it is a microscopic scale where things start, but it happens very quickly. So I do a lot of work with image correlation, where we map
out. What is that?
Digital image correlation is where you take images as you progressively load a specimen. So we've done some open hole specimen where we take
You're mapping where the fiber is going in 3D space as you're bending the member.
Exactly. We're actually mapping the surface, but we can do it at a very high resolution so we can see fiber effects and resin effects as they affect the surface. And so one of the things we see is if we drill a specimen, open hole tension, we can map that strain field. And so that helps us move forward. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there a little bit. Helps us move forward and develop an understanding of that defect. And so we can quantify, how does the material respond? But one of the things that we see is this happens incredibly fast. So I was down at NASA a few years ago working with a few scientists down there, and we were doing open hole tension of carbon epoxy, pure tension, simple specimen. We had a high-speed camera, and we were imaging at about 500,000 frames a second.
That is extremely fast.
Failure occurred from start to finish over 4 frames.
Wow.
That is.
And when you say failure, is that's catastrophic failure,
catastrophic,
or is that failure within the microstructure?
That is from the moment that we could see failure on the surface, in other words, a crack growth, cracks starting, to when the specimen failed.
So it's literally an explosion.
It is literally.
I mean, not literally.
Not literally, but.
Whatever.
Well, sorry, by literally we mean figuratively. Figuratively, instantaneously.
Right. Wow, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Now, are those astronomical loads or astronomical, like, vibrations? Or are these, like, the kind of things maybe the bicycle person will experience?
You know, it's hard to make that leap. From a coupon like that to a bike. And so I gave a talk at Cyclotech a few months ago. And that's another aspect of where I'm trying to go, is to try to help bridge the gap from coupon to structure, coupon to bike. Uh-huh. And so there's a lot of great FEA work out there. There are a lot of great FEA tools. And, you know, we've never had a better computational ability to analyze these things before. Using those tools, we still need to be careful of what we're putting in. We talked about this at the bar last night, right? The first line I teach my students in FEA is garbage in equals garbage out. And that's not to say everyone's putting garbage in. Most people don't. But we need to be very careful of what we put into our FEA, because then that's one of those major steps.
You've created a new world, and it might not be our world.
Exactly. You said that perfectly. Right. It may not represent the world we're in.
You know, it's funny, because I'm around physics and astronomy people. You know, I'm not an academic. I'm there from, engineering and machining spectrum. I make things for the people that are doing that stuff. But, you know, I get it enough in terms of just classic understanding. And, you know, I explain to students all the time, you know, the physics works perfect every time.
Yeah.
It's just, there's an infinite number of variables.
Exactly.
And we don't know which ones are important.
Exactly. That is the, have you read Nate Silver's book? That's his whole premise.
Oh, is this the signal and noise?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I've read the first third.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's, you know, the first few chapters are, and then everything else is, you know, he shares examples. And
I love reading Nate Silver's stuff.
I do
too. And all the 538 and just, you know, any sort of economical stuff. And, you know, one of the guys I have coffee with at work is a chair of the economics department.
Right.
And not that that's limited to economics, but it's an interesting way of connecting science and the world with economics, because, you know, I say economics is a study of motivation.
Right.
But to understand it, we have to work in a world where we don't know it. There's so much happening. Mm-hmm. We can't pin it down on one thing. We kind of have to use tools and statistical analysis to get to the bottom of what's even happening.
Right.
And like with engineering, you know, you have parameters that you build into your FEA, mm-hmm. but, you know, you kind of have to you have to kind of fall back on your just plain old knowledge
right.
at some point, because your brain and your knowledge, assuming it's good,
right.
is processing so many more variables
right.
that the FEI can't.
I completely agree, and that's, I think you're, you know, taking kind of a Silverian approach, let's say, and he can pat me on the back for that later. Taking an approach like that, I think, is beneficial. Being in this show, it's really fun to see. You know, I walk over to the Argonaut booth and seeing what they have with their frame cut in half. I've never seen a bike company do that before. HIA building a fork here on the floor.
That's wild.
It is. And
I've seen cut in half frames, but the laying up prepreg
yeah.
on the floor, it's like, oh, that's cool. Boy, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, but at the same time, it's like, you know, hey, look, this is how you do it.
Sure.
This is how we're doing it. We've got nothing to hide.
It's not a mystery.
It's not
no
a
magic.
Mystery. Exactly. And it's not everyone kind of in their own corner doing their own thing. This to me has a feel of, look, there are some issues that if we can work together on and share some knowledge, maybe we as a group can make some big leaps. And I think the composite bike industry is ready for that next big leap.
Well, it's definitely, looking at this industry over time and things like that, the rise of the real quality composite small builder mm-hmm. is really coming into vogue.
Yeah.
We saw some stuff basically sticking some tubes together in the past, and now, bladder molded stuff is
yeah.
common.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you were talking about, Nate Silver and all
yeah.
that stuff and cutaway bikes. Have you been paying attention to that guy? I can't remember. He's got a YouTube channel where he cuts all the product apart.
Rahul. Sorry, Rahul. I'm spacing your last name. If you hear this.
Yeah. If you like carbon, it's his
yeah.
website's crazy. He's always cutting somebody's stuff apart.
It is.
And
yeah.
you get to see defects on
yep.
a macro sense. I mean,
yeah.
obviously macro stuff, but famous name builders. Look at this. They bunched up some carbon.
Yep.
It broke.
Yep.
Obviously, type of thing. And that's probably a really good connection the average person can see that you're thinking about, except you're thinking about that stuff
right.
really down deep.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, we put this stuff in tools, we bladder mold it, and fibers migrate. There's little we can do about that. And it's the nature of the manufacturing processes that we're working with. And in some cases, it's worse than others. And in some cases, it results in fiber bunching. And, Rahul has some great examples of that and showed a ton of them at Cyclotech when I saw his talk.
Okay. You saw him in person there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It was actually, it was fun. I gave the talk and he gave a talk right after me. So
wow.
It was kind of, it was fun. I think what he's showing, everybody in the industry knows that stuff is happening, and we're trying to figure out ways to understand it. And if we understand it, we can prevent it. If we understand it, we can detect it, and know how to, whether it's...
You won't be able to find something unless you know what you're looking
exactly,
for.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so...
And hopefully we'll get like a microwave scanner or something that,
yeah.
that you can go over the surface and it really shows that there's a problem.
Absolutely. And I think, ultrasonics have been great with that, CT scanning. It's...
What's the best out there in terms of commercial? Like, say I've got a carbon bike and I'm worried, or I'm a worry wart,
yep.
or whatever, and I just want to have it checked over.
Yeah.
What's the premier stuff that could possibly be put into someone's hands to do that right now?
That's a great question. There are a lot of tools out there, and each one works well in certain cases.
What are the cases?
I would say ultrasonics is probably the easiest, right? You can buy an ultrasonic tool. Rahul shows them pretty
much. My obstetrician has one.
Exactly. Exactly. And your dentist has a CT scanner too, right? So it's...
I think I'm tooled up.
So for some of my PhD research, we CT scans composite laminates at a dentist's office. And so it's... So there's that aspect. I'm a big fan, again, of image correlation. If we can understand and know that we have, okay, we have this good FEA based on material properties that we got from our own testing that includes...
Not from the manufacturer's specification.
Exactly. That includes... And we like that because it includes our processing, right? So our processing variables are then included in our material properties. And so we have that. We have, you know, good solid FEA, which, again, a lot of people are doing. There are great tools out there. Then we take we load the frame, and we compare the two. We get, Carl likes the term heat maps. We get our contour maps that show strain, and we can compare the two. And if we get an unexpected strain variation, in, let's say, the head tube area, then we can dig into that and say, okay, why is this happening?
And this isn't something that only affects the bikes from a failure point of view, but it's like we try to talk a lot about ride quality and how the bike handles and stiffness. If a head tube's wobbling out in space because of something deep within the carbon that you didn't expect, you're going to have a crappy bike.
Yeah.
And if you can figure that out, that's going to help, even if it doesn't kill you.
Absolutely. It fits in again with that whole understanding going from kind of that coupon level to that rideable frame of, how can we make these bikes better?
Okay. Let's get back into, let's say, bikes and what you folks are doing with Pursuit. I talked to Carl and he's talking about your molds and you got some aluminum molds.
Yep.
And you're doing a bladder layup with prepreg. How involved are you in planning out the let's say the patterns and the cuts and the layups? How does that work? I'm extremely inexperienced when it comes to the practical working with carbon end of things. I get it. I get stuff, but
yeah.
I don't know the nuts and bolts. So tell me about your laying up. Tell me about how you're looking at the mold and getting it done, just hands-on, and are you there doing it?
I am not. So I live in New York. They're in Bozeman, Montana. So it's we're on the phone regularly. We Skype a lot. We have a great resource in Bozeman, Montana.
I
know, exactly.
You could have a six-day enduro race there now.
I know, exactly. It's one of my favorite things about Montana is we call it the country of Montana. So it's there's a few thousand miles in between us. We are working with an incredible engineer, industrial designer named Jeff Wyatt. He has a company called Pinion Engineering. They generated the rendering that we have, that we've put out, and it's beautiful.
The visuals.
The visuals, exactly. And we've had a few people come up to us in Carl's booth here this week and say, hey, where's the Pursuit frame?
Right.
And it's kind of fun to see that.
It does. You know what? You're right. I actually kind of assumed it was real because you're launching and all.
Yeah.
And it's a rendering. I'll take a closer look next time.
Yeah. And so Jeff's incredible. So.
So is he doing? Is he more on? He's the manufacturing end of things.
No, he's more the industrial design end.
Okay.
So he's helping us kind of come up with the design that we want, the frame, with the details that we want. To make it unique as Pursuit, with geometries that we specify and so forth, and I'll let you talk to Carl more about those specifics.
Sure.
He's a bike guy. I'm just a composites guy.
But you're talking to him about the layout.
Absolutely. So so what will happen from there is we'll basically use that to generate tools, and then start to generate ply patterns.
I'm sure you're getting pretty involved when it comes to radii. Just in terms of, how that layup's going to go, some of the patterns. But, you can, because of what you've said, you're predicting a bunching. You're predicting a separation. You're predicting some of these things, and that's what you're trying to do is head that stuff off right from the design.
Yeah.
So that you're making it as easy as possible for the material to succeed.
Absolutely. Absolutely, that's the case. And that goes into, how many tools we're making and where we're partitioning the frame and so on and so forth. And then Carl and I will collaborate on the actual ply patterns and so forth. And that is a discussion we are currently having. And I'll be honest, anyone that says they have a ply pattern designed before they've built anything, and it's going to change.
Well, I was surprised looking at that guy wrapping the fork over there.
Yeah.
Just how sloppy the process can be.
Yeah.
You know, we're used to seeing, you know, the typical like trek marketing or giant marketing stuff with, you know, nice cutouts, nice slapping the piece on. But when you get in those crowded areas, ew.
I'm going to leave it that you said sloppy, not me.
Well, I'm not criticizing the guy's work. I have no idea if he's doing it. Yeah. It's just there's some tricky stuff that goes on.
And there's a lot in the design that, you know, that allows for, you know, they have designed from what I've seen. And this is a quick overview. I was over there about 5 minutes when they started yesterday. Yeah. And I took a walk over when they finished yesterday. And what I saw looked like a part that was ready to go into the mold. And the ply patterns that I saw, that's going to blow up into a beautiful part in the mold.
Right. You almost, when you're putting it together, you're predicting a final shape. It's not the end result.
Exactly.
And you kind of have to, like, you know, it's a moving target, not a moving target, but it's like, it's going to grow.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And it's
so, you know, we're in the bicycle industry, and it's easy to talk about what General Motors is going to do for a part or what NASA is going to use or General Dynamics. But, you know, there's a necessary economization that has to happen here. And while you can talk about the perfect carbon structure and bike, there's the producing something that someone of some even considerable means can afford. How are you approaching that when you have to say, you know, it's not perfect, but it's fine?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's... I'm going to dodge it by answering a slightly different question.
Good, you know, man.
I think that the economics in composite frames and composites in general, it's, you know, so much money and so much cost has been pulled out of the material. It's the material is more available, more readily available now than it's ever been. And, you know, in a way we have Boeing to thank for that. With the shortage of material that existed.
Is Boeing really the leader when it comes to that in terms of, like,
so with
changing the market?
With the 777, right?
Sure.
They required so much material. There was a big shortage for a while. And it took a little while for the carbon manufacturers to crank up. And so now there's a lot more material available than there's ever been. And the cost has come down. But in order for these materials to really see a cost reduction, and this is for General Motors. I mean, when I worked on the Corvette hood for GM, the issue wasn't the material cost. The issue was the production cost, the manufacturing cost. And these materials, they take a lot of hand time. They take a lot of technician
work. That's why China produces the carbon bikes, is because it's ours. And it's not so much the material. It's like we can't pay that hours here in the U.S. type
yeah.
of thing.
So you look at, I'm spacing the name of the company in Newton, Iowa, that makes wind turbine blades. These things are huge, 90 meters long. They put down huge amounts of fiberglass and then infuse it. I got a tour of the facility and went through with their chief engineer. And he said to me, he said, you know, there is nothing on this planet that can lay down as much material as quickly as human beings.
Really?
And it's just the pounds per hour it's astronomically different. It's orders of magnitude different between.
So have you seen robots trying to apply this stuff or anything
yeah,
like that?
Yeah.
And they just can't compete with humans?
Not yet.
That's really interesting.
They're making strides, but it's we're
why is that, do you think? Just the amount of decision making and the dexterity and decisions connected and rapid movement.
Absolutely. Yeah, the number of variables that that are changing. It's, you know, you make a fork today, let's say, and you know, it's 70 degrees out and 10% humidity. And then tomorrow we get a front that comes through, and if your factory isn't, you know, all these variables change, and they change how the material responds.
And then the robot doesn't have a map in it that
exactly
corresponds to that.
Exactly. It's not yet. Not yet. It's,
sure.
They
get better.
Exactly. And so, yeah, and humans can respond to that. They can make adjustments. They can see when, you know, things are deviating just a little bit and make a correction. in such a way that robotics cannot quite yet.
Say I'm a small frame builder and I'm looking to get my hands wet with composites and work with it more. You know, you're coming at it from a very advanced academic level, but what are the pitfalls and what are the real joys that you try to push when thinking about that?
Jeez, I don't know. That's I mean, the pitfalls are it's a tough material to work with. It takes practice, and as I just said, it's really not exactly the same twice. You know, we do our best, and you know, companies like Rockwest Composites that have been around forever, you know, they see variation, and they do everything they can to make it so that the same tube comes out the same every time, and they take a lot of good measures, and they're very good at it. They do a phenomenal job.
The stuff I'm buying from Rockwest, they make?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know what you're buying, but they're right down the street.
You sure. What are the real things that are just marvelous about it? I mean, obviously you love it. You've been around it a long time. There's got to be something that you just go, oh, isn't this magic? You know.
I love this material because it's anisotropic. You know, that's we're kind of coming around full circle here, right? That's one of the reasons we have a hard time understanding it too. Is anisotropy is tough. It's, you know, we take this material.
I'm drawing a blank on anisotropy.
Okay, so isotropy is when a material behaves the same when loaded in any direction. Anisotropy is when it's it responds differently when loaded in different directions.
As an engineer, you can program how the beam reacts.
Exactly. So if we think of a single lamina, right? And I take my when I talk about this in class, I take my shoes off and use a shoelace. So we can pull on that shoelace in tension, and it does pretty well. We push on it, and you know, in compression, it's not very good, right? It's, you know, what happens when you push on a rope, right? We all learn that in Boy Scouts.
Right.
It's it doesn't do much for us. So it's and likewise, you know, if you pull on it kind of from the sides, usually I wear Vans, so I have some nice fat laces I can pull on. But if you pull on it from the sides, it's not the same response. It's not quite as stiff. It's not quite as strong. And so it's, you know, that's anisotropy.
It's highly optimized in one direction.
Exactly.
And almost ignored in others.
Exactly. So if you, you know, Hartsmith wrote some papers a few years ago, and basically we have a longitudinal modulus in the fiber direction that's about 10 times greater than the transverse. And that's for carbon epoxy, that's a good rule of thumb. So you think about it, we have this material that is 10 times stronger, 10 times stiffer, excuse me, in one direction than the other direction. All of a sudden, then we start orienting it, you know, at plus minus 45s, 90s, quasi-isotropic, all these different things that we try to do, and it's not so easy to understand. We try to make it isotropic so that it's easier for us to understand. And I think that's, in my mind, that's one of the things I'm trying to decouple in my research, is treat it as an anisotropic material and try to understand it layer by layer a little bit more. It's
cool. Thank you so much for the inner look at carbon fibers. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. My pleasure. Take care.
Cool.